Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's returning guest is Cathy Unsworth. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Stuart, and thanks for having me back.
My pleasure, my pleasure. Now, last time, Bad Bunny Booze, we talked about films that were sort of inspirations to or part of the texture of that book. And now we're going to do it. We're going to look at a book of yours called Season of the Witch, The Book of Goth, which is it's like a social history of pop culture through the seam of what you are defining as where goth comes from and what goth become. But I mean, I'll allow you to describe it how you want to describe the book.
Yeah, no, well, my initial idea was to look at goth in the period when Margaret Thatcher took power too, when she gets kicked out. That's hence the Season of the Witch.
So
it starts after, I think that punk disrupted the music world in the same way that Margaret Thatcher disrupts the political system. And so it starts with the bands that first came out directly out of punk, which is the Banshees and Joy Division magazine and The Cure, who were there at the time. And then sort of travels through the decade in line with the sort of tumultuous events that we go through in that decade when Margaret Thatcher disrupts the whole of the post-war consensus, and the music kind of reacts to that. I think it really does, and goes from, in, you know, her privatization, how she took on the unions, how she basically smashed everything to pieces in the middle of the decade with the miner strike, and how it ends on this deregulated economy sort of high on the hog of its own hubris, really, and how the music follows that, and how all the various youth cultures surrounding goth play into that as well, into that story. So that was my framework, and that was how I first approached it as a timeline of the 80s, really.
And it's a really interesting way to sort of use that as your skeleton for building the story, because it would have been very easy, I think, to do a here's this music, here's that band, and they form that band. I mean, and I'll repeat what I was saying to you before we started recording. For me, anyone that's read David Cavanagh's book about Creation Records, I think what you've done with this story of goth is very similar in terms of a wider story as well as a specific story about. You can follow the band's line in the book as far as what I've read so far, but equally, like you say, the context of the culture that it was in, that pop music doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from somewhere.
Yeah, and actually films and film soundtrack music is really important to all the bands that are in the book. Because it's interesting to me how it differs from Nevermind the Bollocks straight away, how Susie's The Scream and how Unknown Pleasures do sound far more cinematic than that. And they're coming from a different sound palette entirely as well. And, you know, the Banshees were very influenced by Bernard Herrmann's music and Psycho. And, you know, you can hear that. And Martin Hannett, when he was producing Joy Division, he wanted it to sound like the desolate city after all the post-war rebuild had been going on in Manchester. And And the band talked about how that had actually affected them. The dislocation of their communities was split up and sent to live in high rises. So I think you can hear all of that imprinted in their music. So whether it isn't directly political, it is a comment on the time and the place that it was made, a really big comment.
Oh, I mean, I don't know if you've come across it, Andy Spinoza's book about the sort of the economic and cultural change in Manchester, the same more or less the same period as your book, really, when you talk about Thatcher, and then it kind of kicks on into the urban renaissance. But he starts, his ground zero is Thatcher Records and Hacienda.
Yeah.
As being the reason for the urban renewal of Manchester, not government initiatives, not...
No, indeed, no. It's true, and that's such an ironic... I mean, I also like the way that factory has so many meanings.
Yeah.
You know, to us Derek Raymond fans, factory is the police station, and that was slang in common parlance in Sweeney at the time. But also it's a homage to Andy Warhol, and his studios in New York, and the way that they labelled all the products was very Warholian as well. But the fact that, bringing a manufacturing base back to Manchester, indeed.
But also as well, I think with that punk thing of certainly from what Malcolm McLaren was doing, and Wilson picked up on it, the whole kind of situationist element of the spectacle, not the profit, I suppose. I mean, obviously there was part of that that became the money muddied things, but certainly the spectacle was the most important thing at the very first, wasn't it?
Yeah, and also I think Jim Furwell, aka Fetus, he said it brilliantly to me about how, because he came to London in the late 70s, and he actually got there before the birthday party, who were his mates in Melbourne, and he got a job in the Virgin Megastore, but he was also started to do music almost immediately. And amusingly enough, his flatmate or squatmate was Keith Allen from the comic strip.
Really?
Yes. One of my favourite bits of research was this one. They were all living in a squat in Ladbroke Grove, and Nicky Sudden was in there living in a broom cupboard in the squat. But it was really funny to me because the Batcave Club, the big goth club where everyone met, was at the same address, 69 Dean Street, as the comic strip where that began. So between the Nell Gwynn Strip Club Review was all the goths and all the modern, new comedians coming through. So
What fascinated me with the way you start, and it feels like it starts in Manchester, which to me is a big surprise growing up in Manchester. Not because I think it's wrong. It's just that I always grew up with the perception of Leeds being goth and Manchester not being goth. But in saying that, in the late 80s when Manchester was massive, I used to go more so to a place called the Banshee, which unsurprisingly was a goth club in Manchester. And you went downstairs, and it was this fantastical. For me, anyway, for 17, 18-year-old me, it was fantastical. There was, lots of lace, lots of men in corsets with waists that I could not imagine. And I'm from post-industrial North Manchester, so this is a complete and utter new window into a world for me. And we're hearing, Sisters of Mercy, and we're hearing Fields of Nephilim and stuff.
No, amazing. And one of my favourite quotes is from John Langford. He was at Leeds Uni, sort of he became Andrew Eldritch's best friend and was hanging out with him a lot. And there was a pub called the Faversham where they all used to go, and he said it was so brilliant Friday night in the Faversham bogs with all these big brickies going, oh, pass the hairspray.
Some of the stuff that was running parallel with punk, and I really hadn't realised some of the level of how popular the National Front was in terms of voting. You quote some figures about the GLC voting. I remember talking to, and I can't remember his name now, but I think he was the first Cure manager. And he was telling me about, late 70s, early 80s, he said, you'd be a goth coming in on the, and he was talking about coming on the Central Line, and skinheads would jump on at Leytonstone.
That horrible, I know. And Billy Chainsaw, my friend, he was the PA to Susie and the Banshees from 1978 onwards, he had told me how he used to get jumped on and beaten up for being a goth. Mm. It was so frighteningly violent those days. And so those bands were reacting against that. So, you know, one of the things that often gets levelled at Goth is it isn't political, but it really is. And I hope that I demonstrate that throughout the book.
No, I think you do. I think you do. Although a memory that always makes me laugh, and it's got almost like a stereotypical Goth thing. And again, this would be around about, I'm going to say, 1990, and I'm in a squat in Cheetah Mill, I think it is.
Yeah.
And there was this speed dealer punk guy, and there was three Goths sat on a bed together, sharing a 3-litre bottle of cider. And this guy was obviously whizzing his tits off. And he just says, "For God's sake, bleach your hair blonde and have a laugh for once, will you?" And I'll never forget the picture, because they just looked up and went, anyway, carry on with the cider.
The three little Goths. Modern day fairy story.
Indeed. Because you've written, you cover so much detail, and you've mentioned the Keith Allen bit of your research. And one thing I always ask when I speak to documentarians is, you know, you can set out with a perception of where you might end up and what you might find out. But what for you in this journey of like putting this under the microscope and doing the book as opposed to the idea for the book, what for you was your favourite sort of parallel or discovery that you could put to Goth and in popular culture terms that you wouldn't have done had you not written the book?
My favourite one is the fact that Killing Joke and Arthur Daly came from exactly the same place at exactly the same time.
No.
Yeah. This road, and it's an interesting, very psychogeographically interesting road, Portland Road in Holland Park.
Right.
There was a fascinating series a few years back about London roads and how they had appeared on Booth's poverty map in Victorian times when he charted all the slums of London and how they are now.
Mm.
And this was the one that had gone the most upwardly mobile from being part of what was then called Notting Dale, which was the villainous quarter under Notting Hill, where there'd been piggeries and potteries in the past and where the Teds were in the 50s. Mm. And it had been, there's a crossroads, which is always important to mythology. Mm. And on one side of this crossroads is the really big, tall houses, which are now owned, it's now the richest street in London, and it's a bankster's paradise. It's where all those hedge fund people have gone to live. But in 1979, Killing Joke were in a squat in that road, which shows you what the area was like at those times, because it was still very much the area that posh people didn't want to go, because all the West Indians had come there since the 1950s, and Peter Rackham was one of the few people who would put them up, and it was a world of radical politics as well. And this feeds into my research of Bad Penny Please, of course, because this is where IT Magazine and Oz Magazine start, and it was cheap rents and a place where young people on the dole, as most people were in the early 1980s, and that's, you know, that's Margaret Thatcher's fault, but also it's also a well of extreme creativity. So Killing Joke had a squat on this road, and their first single comes out in, I think it's August 1979.
Right.
At exactly the same time, Minder, Arthur Daly, the Winchester Club, is next on Clarendon Cross on this road. It's next door to this pub, bistro, sorry, called Julie's, where TV executives would hang out. And I have no doubt that Houston Films made Minder, who also made The Sweeney, and it was supposed to be a vehicle for Dennis Waterman, but Arthur Daly sort of takes over. But he's such an avatar of the 80s. He is, you know, what Mark Thatcher is talking about. But he's also a throwback to the Spivs of the 30s, which he used to play.
Of course he did,
So no one better than George Cullen. He pops up at exactly the same time and same place as Killing Joke to be, like, he is the punchline of the Killing Joke. They're saying in their songs this terrible stuff is going to happen because of monetarism, and so it passes, and there he is, the living embodiment of dodgy off the back of a lorry monetarism.
Indeed. The epitome of deregulation.
Yeah,
and individualism.
He's nice little ears. And as he used to refer to Margaret Thatcher as her indoors at number 10.
Indeed he did, yeah. And now, I've not got this far in the book, but what, and I mentioned it already, because like growing up the other side of the Pennines from Leeds and Yorkshire, what do you think it was about Leeds being such a sort of hotbed for what became, I guess, the mainstream end of
well, what, it was John Keenan's F Club, I think. Well, it's a sort of convergence of things. He started this club in Leeds Poly.
Hmm.
And there's a lot of really soft sell went to Leeds
Poly. That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and then Andrew Eldritch came in 78 to study Chinese, but kind of got lost on his way and ended up in the F Club and met the amazing DJ Claire Shearsby, who was, all my sources say, the coolest person in Leeds. He fell in love with her and he re-emerges as Andrew Eldritch. I think the universities were full of really, the Sex Pistols had played there and John Langford said he saw them like on one of his first nights in town as a student coming to the Eugene. They also had TJ Clark as their teacher, who was the one British member of the Situationist International, so it comes back to what you're saying about. And he like infected them. So the Mekons, the Delta Five and Gang of Four all founded within the first week of
Yeah, Gary. That's yeah.
And then Annie Hogan went to Leeds Uni as well to study politics, but then quickly found herself in the Faversham Bar and she ended up DJing and she met Soft Cell. While she was DJing, she met Dave and Mark and ended up being their flatmate. So I think it was a really fantastic scene. And also, it's kind of, it's at the centre, isn't it, of Atkinson Grimshaw's Leeds is, you know, the great Gothic painter of Leeds in its Victorian pomp. And Leeds is where, you know, the Industrial Revolution starts in that part of Yorkshire, really, and all the mining villages around it spread out. There's David Peace was so funny talking about how there was all these little golf clubs in all these little villages surrounding Leeds, Wakefield, Bradford. And then I also find it really interesting that Leeds, Bradford were against each other throughout history.
Mm. Since
William the Conqueror protected Leeds and harried the rest of the north. And they were always against each other until Gough and the miners' strike united them.
Oh, wow.
Common. Yes. So, yeah, because Bradford's really fertile with New Model Army. And
that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you get to Hebden Bridge and everyone's got clogs, haven't they?
Yeah, exactly. And I thought it was really quite amazing that William Blake is there at the start of the Industrial Revolution talking about the dark satanic mills coming up there in Yorkshire and, well, across the land. And then as the miners' strike, that's the end of the Industrial Revolution, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
And then you've got Justin Sullivan quoting Blake's Jerusalem in 1984, their New Model Army song about, you know, the end of everything, the miners' strikes, how it destroyed their communities and everything around it. So, yeah, we're more than all these things have happened there before in the times of the Civil War and the times of the War of the Races. And, you know, since these have been the battlefields of the nation's soul, basically.
No, well, it's interesting because in a popular sense, Manchester and Liverpool have never sort of been pals, as it were, even though the likes of Anthony Wilson and Tom Bloxham, the developer, would often want to sort of make the Northwest a region so you could have the two cities in, but they just, because of the age-old politics of the place. But I remember, I've spoken to musicians on both sides, and the musicians always see the commonality between the people because obviously they play to each other's audiences.
Yeah.
It's just the kind of rivalry that just, I mean, I don't know, you know, whatever the reasons are. I used to, because my dad's from Liverpool and I grew up in Manchester, so that was always something that I was very conscious of. So if I, weirdly, to bring it back to Goth, when I used to go to football in the 90s, so I'd get the train from Manchester to Liverpool, Warrington was like the ley line between Goth and Scally.
Wow.
So you'd have the Goths going into Manchester and the Scallies going to Liverpool. It was this weird, weird, I mean,
that. Anything, isn't it?
It's just a complete anecdotal research there, but it was just you go to the game on a Saturday and then you'd have the people who'd be going into Manchester to, because the around Victoria Station Goss would hang out and stuff, just, you know, teenagers as teenagers would do, like.
Sure, yeah.
But yeah, no, it was a really interesting thing to observe, that kind of literally going two different directions, but Warrington was where the split was.
Amazing. It'd be great to do a youth culture map of Britain, wouldn't it?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing for me, and what this harks me back to, and I feel like Father Time when I do it, is because I've been teaching at a university this last year. And one thing I noticed, I mean, it's only a small university, but nevertheless, it's got you know, hundreds of people. There's no obvious tribal ways of people looking, dressing. I couldn't guess what one person was into from another. Whereas I went to Birmingham Poly, 91, 94.
Yeah.
And you could just look around the student union and know who's into what because of how they looked. And certainly a goth you could spot from 100 yards.
Well, this was the great thing about goth. I could see... I could spot people across the vast fields of Norfolk, my fellow field goths.
Because I was always more, I guess, goth curious than I was full on goth. I mean, I had the biker jacket, but I was like godflesh and things like that by that point. More that, because industrial is obviously a cousin, isn't it?
Well, it sort of comes from Killing Joke and Beaver anyway. Yeah. Lots of their early stuff has a massive effect on.
Season of the Witch, Book of Goth, is out now. What's the best place for people to get it from if they're going to go and buy it? Where would you say to go buy it from?
Well, I would say try and buy it from your local indie bookstore if you can, because it's got good distribution and it should be there. Or obviously it's going to be in Waterstone. Or there's a website called The Goth Shop where you can buy it.
That'd be quite meta to buy it from there.
Hey, y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
I'll put a link in the show notes then.
Thank you very much. Yeah, so that you can get it from Rough Trade online as well if you haven't got a local Rough Trade shop too. So, yeah.
Brilliant. I'll put those links in the show notes so people can make that easy for people.
Thank you.
And now we've ventured out of goth, we're going to venture into three films that have impacted everything in your adult life.
Yes, absolutely.
For the uninitiated who hasn't heard this before, you'll come into this show first time round. The rules are straightforward. Kathy's given me three movies. We're going to talk about each movie for 5 minutes at a time. And when we hear this sound... You hear that okay at your end, Kathy?
Oh, yeah. Chilling me, sir.
DEFCON 1. When DEFCON 1 happens, that's the end of 5 minutes and we move on to the next film. That seem okay?
Yes.
Brilliant. Yeah. Well, look, let's jump back. I mean, the lead guy's outfit is very goth in many ways. Let's jump back to 1955 to Night of the Hunter. Do you want to tell us about where that comes into your life and how you see it and what the impact is?
This is the film that haunts my goth book, actually, and it haunted me ever since I first saw it. It's Charles Laughton, the great British actor, his only film, Hollywood film, as a director.
Okay.
It stars Robert Mitchum in his probably most charismatic role as preacher Harry Powell, a con man who is here in prison that as he's about to be let out of a fortune, a widow living in this little sleepy town in the Midwest America, halfway America. He hears this vulnerable widow. He goes dutifully out to court her. He's got love tattooed on one knuckle and hate tattooed on the other. And
Remember the frames in the film.
Yeah, and he's with his black Stetson on and his outfit. He was very much imitated by one of my favourite goth singers, the Gun Club's Jeffrey Lee Pierce. He grew on Preacher Power for his imagery. And then Nick Cave also, I think, became enamoured of the same film and drew upon him. And one of his videos, actually, the one he did with Kylie Minogue, Where the Wild Roses Grow, is a direct homage to the beautiful world of Night of the Hunter that
I'd never thought of that.
That Lawton created. And it's up there. Sidney Cortez is his director of photography, who said he was always called upon to do weird things. And they make this landscape into a dark fairy tale, because the day after Preacher Powell, Shelley Winters is playing the widow in question, whose name is Willa Harper. And she's got two little children who are not quite so taken by their new stepdaddy. And the day after they get married, Shelley is, we don't know where she is, but the rest of the town don't, but her car is in the bottom of the lake, and there's an amazing scene with her hair floating like in the water like seaweed, and the little children have to go on the run from Robert Mitchum, and he stalks them through the night, and they take a raft down the stream, and it's like a gleaming world with little frogs and little creatures, and they're rafting down this moonbeam river, and he's just following casually along behind them on his horse, singing these old cowboy songs and always managing to keep a pace with them, like a nightmare. It's the feeling you get in a nightmare. And, yeah, it was so powerful, but unfortunately, and Robert Mitchum and Shelley Winters both said it was the best film they'd ever worked on, and the one with the director was the best director to work from that they ever had. And they were both completely different actors. She did the method, and obviously Robert Mitchum could learn the script overnight and just went with it. But they both said they'd never worked with such a good director as Charles Lawton, but it didn't go down very well on its initial release.
I was going to say, for 1955, this was a fairly subversive movie, wasn't it? Because Peeping Tom and we predate Psycho, don't we?
Yeah, this is a sort of blueprint for David Lynch to follow, this film. And I think Elephant Man looks quite a lot like Night of the Hunter as well. The weird, beautiful black and white noir imagery, that fairy tale, and that little thing of innocence. You know, the children are the innocence. And when I watched Elephant Man again, I couldn't help but being struck by the fact that he was such an innocent and such an outsider.
Do you remember when you first saw Night of the Hunter, how it came to your attention?
I actually saw it around Billy Chainsaw's flat, who I mentioned earlier.
All right.
It was in about 1991 when I first met him, because I had done a bit of work for Susie in those days for her Superstition album. I did a biog.
Okay.
He lived near me on Portobello Road, near Portobello Road, and he showed it to me, and I was absolutely mesmerised by this film and haunted by it. And I think it's the one that has stood the test of time for me. Mm. It never loses its power every time I watch it. It's so beautiful and so disturbing, and nobody could have played that part. Really scarily, it is based on a real person as well.
And when
you look up Harry Powers, the real guy, he did get away with murdering. Well, he got caught in the end, but he did murder two women and their children. So the children escaped thanks to Charles Lawton.
Oh!
There's our 5 minutes, Kathy.
We have to move on to another black and white fable.
We do, but in a way, it's weird. As you were talking about it, I'm thinking the next film is almost like an exact opposite in many ways, in terms of relationship between a kind of enigmatic adult and a group of children. I'm indeed talking about 1961's Whistle Down the Wind.
the most beautiful film, shot in the Lancashire countryside near Clitheroe, and directed by Brian Forbes. It's the story of three little children who find a runaway murderer living in their hayton. But mistake him for Jesus.
It's so amazing setup. It's such an amazing setup.
And it's so beautiful how innocent those children are. And the it's scripted. It was based on a book. Hayley Mills plays the oldest of the children, and she's wonderful in this part. Alan Bates plays Jesus, or the fella in the hayloft. And he's probably in his rugged Heathcliff-esque prime in this.
He is, 61.
Yeah, and lovely Bernard Lee plays their dad, who I always love to see Bernard Lee in any film. He is so solidly dad-like and brilliant. And one of my literary heroes, Keith Waterhouse, wrote the script with his partner, Willis Hall. It was based on a novel that Hayley Mills' mum wrote, which had been set in Kent, but they roughed it up a bit and set it up north. The little brother, he's got spectacles. He's the most wonderful actor. I'm just trying to look up his name. Sadly, I can't even remember his name. He's so wonderful. He is like a little mini Keith Waterhouse. He's the voice of...
Is he Norman Bird? Is it Eddie?
No, Norman Bird is the old... He's the one who chucks the cats into the reservoir.
Okay, yeah.
He's kind of a staple for... Because Dickie Attenborough, he produced it, and Brian Forbes, who directed it, sort of became a team, a really brilliant team, and they made loads of fantastic films together. And he was one of their regular ensemble cast, he was.
Ah, right.
He's in loads of them. He's in... The Fantastic League of Gentlemen with them as well, which before they started doing their own films, but that's Brian Forbes wrote the screenplay for that. And so he's always turns up in their films and he's brilliant. But anyway, this little boy is basically like the little Keith Waterhouse, and he has these brilliant moments when the girls are really carried away by the fact Jesus is in the hayloft, and he gets really annoyed and says, "It's not Jesus, it's just some fella."
That's a cracking line.
It's brilliant. And anyway, it's kind of a story about, you know, they believe in that. And there's all this allegory to the Bible, and that they are betrayed, and that the disciples come to the hay barn, all their friends come from school to see the little baby Jesus. And then Hayley Mills goes to ask the local vicar about, you know, how can it be true? And he can't really answer her question. And then, you know, I don't want to put a plot spoiler on it, actually, because I remember pasting up something about this film one Christmas time saying, we always watch it at Christmas with my father-in-law. It's one of his favourite films. And now it's become my default Christmas movie. And one of my friends who had quite young children at the time said, I'm going to show it to my daughters. And first of all, they went, oh, no, Mum, not a black and white film. And then they were spellbound.
Oh, that's good to hear, isn't it?
Because I think good storytelling, it don't matter, does it?
No. So how did this sort of come across your...
This was actually another part of Bad Penny Blues, because I started getting really seriously into Brian Forbes and Dickie Attenborough and what they'd done together through the L-shaped dream, which they, the Lynn Banks.
Yeah.
And weirdly enough, I was just reading up a little bit. I didn't realise that, first of all, Hayley Mills' mum was not happy with Brian Forbes' decision to set the film in Lancashire rather than Kent. And I got the opportunity to meet Lynn Lee Banks, and she didn't like the fact that he'd also moved the location of her original novel from Fulham into Ladbroke Grove. But it makes total sense for it to be that film to be in Ladbroke Grove, because that's where she would have met all these characters that she meets in the film, with the jazz musician, the prostitute. They all would have lived in Ladbroke Grove at that time, whereas maybe not in Fulham. And I think this just works so much better that it's in that beautiful landscape.
Yeah.
You know, and the voices of the little children are so brilliant in that local dialect that Waterhouse brought to that story. It roughed it up a little.
I was going to say, it's interesting, because I didn't know that the switch of location. I just can't imagine it being anywhere but.
No. And it's because what we just talked about, being the sort of industrial heartland of Britain. I know.
5 minutes again.
And now we have to cross the sea to a faraway place.
We do, we do. And it's probably the least gothic.
It's not really, except for in it, the subject matter is pretty grim and gothic.
Indeed it is, indeed it is. We're talking about 1990s film by Martin Scorsese, Goodfellas. Did you see this at the cinema? Did you get to see
it? Yes, I did. I saw it when it came out in the King's Road, at a cinema at the end of the King's Road, and it blew my tiny mind. It's the music is so fantastic, and the way everything looks is so fantastic. It's Martin Scorsese's probably most successful realisation of everything he's into in one movie.
I totally agree, yeah, yeah.
And with such a wonderful cast as well, with Joe Pesci and Robert De Niro and Ray Liotta, sadly no longer with us, and the brilliant Lorraine Bracco, all, and Paul Sorvino as Paulie, the gang boss. So, yeah, you're swept away into the world of this little boy who always wanted to be a gangster because he didn't want to be a square and he didn't want to be like all the schmoes on this sidewalk, and it's in this beautiful world of doo-wop and brilliant 60s music on the jukebox and these suave Italian guys, sharp-suited, not having to work like everybody else. You can totally see why he falls in love with this world and wants to not be, which in a way has, I think, its analogies with youth culture. That's why we all try not to be normal and boring when we're his age, when he gets drawn into seeing this glamorous guy sitting over the street, sitting outside at night and wants to be part of the world. It's that, yeah, they look superb. They don't have to work. I want to be like them. That's why people join bands, isn't it?
Indeed, indeed. I mean, I don't remember what the big, I mean, it's a film that's so established as canon now. And like you said, and it probably was commercially his biggest hit still, I think, to this day. And it's the one that, you know, it's evergreen because it never tires. But when it was fresh and you're seeing it at the cinema, can you recall like the atmosphere of coming out of the cinema from that one?
Yeah, I was absolutely blown away by it. And the soundtrack had a massive amount to do with how, and I think that's something Scorsese does brilliantly. And he was inspired by Kenneth Anger, who also recently sadly passed, although he did leave The Devil Does Look After His Own. He was 96. So, but he was the first person to use that on Scorpio Rising. They sang exactly the same sort of beautiful 60s songs that Scorsese would use as an ironic commentary on the action. Scorsese does that so brilliantly in Goodfellas. You go from Tony Bennett singing Rags to Riches to when it all starts going nasty, you start getting Cream, The Sunshine of My Life. And then it ends when it's all gone totally tits up with Sid Vicious singing My Way. And the trajectory of the story matches the music going from this sort of teenage love on the streets of Brooklyn to it all getting corrupted. And as the 60s gets darker and darker as well, and, you know, it all goes, he loses all his dreams and everything through greed and avarice.
Yeah, I mean, it's
pride, and you know, Scorsese wanted to be a priest at some point, so he's showing you the moral outcome.
Yeah,
if you take this path, and how you're going to end up in the suburbs having marinara sauce with tomato ketchup on noodles, and that's going to be your fate to be forever worse than you died when you were a kid. So it's a powerful story, and that's another reason why I think that it keeps fresh and it keeps its resonance, you know.
But it's interesting because the way I think Scorsese does really well, which is as the impact on its audience, is that while we get the moral lesson, same with Wolf of Wall Street, but we don't lose our affection for the glamour and the excitement and the rebellion. We don't think never do that. We just think, oh, you know, they're but for the grace of God or whatever. But you don't think, it's almost like you don't think bad of them. He manages to tell you a story which is morally reprehensible and you can accept that and you're not fighting that. But then you also go, yeah, but it's a bit cool as well, though, isn't it?
I know, because they even manage, when, even they're in prison making the spaghetti and getting...
That is such a moment.
That's the one that... I used to watch this film 5 billion times with my brother, and every Friday night we would try and recreate the scene. Not literally with the razor blade.
I was going to say, I've never been able to slice my garlic that fine.
But we want to be eating good Italian food by the end of watching the film. It's amazing, yeah.
Oh, man.
Hey, that was a quick...
It was. Well, look, that's your that's three films that have impacted everything in your adult life, Cathy.
Yes.
Thank you for sharing those. They were, that was a good mix. And I'm not sure if it was on purpose or not, but it was a lovely segue to go from the chat about Goth into Night of the Hunter.
Yeah, no, I did want that one to be first because I think that probably is my favourite film of all time. And yeah, it does haunt my Goth book, and you'll see it popping up all over the place.
Brilliant.
In the book, yeah.
Well, look, I've not read all the book yet. And for the listeners who are hearing this conversation, I mean, one of the things that I'm enjoying about the book so far is that you, Cathy, you write us into the moment like we're in it now, you know, and I think that's a real powerful part of your writing that I've really enjoyed so far. It's really interesting, but having read your novels and I'd obviously read your journalism before.
But yeah, I don't think I could have written this book though if I hadn't read all those novels first.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It teaches you the discipline and the structure of, but also you've got to tell a really good story.
Mm.
And with this amount of material, you've got to focus on what your narrative is, the way you do when you tell the story. So I think it's really, you know, it's all fed into each other. It's like I've been in training my whole life to write this book.
Well, it shows. It's really tight, and it's real. And it feels, but like what like I say, when you put us in the action, I feel like you've sort of got your finger on the pulse of something. You know, you've got us to what's exciting or why excitement's going to come almost. You know, you're setting up the excitement as well as you're going, isn't it exciting?
It's the spinning nationwide wheel of memory. That's how I think of it.
Beautifully put. But it's, I do, I mean, you mentioned the term before, but I do, the kind of psychogeography side of it is the bit that I find, when you're taking us to different parts of the country, and it's the same time, it's the same year, or it's the 12 months later. So why should it be so different? Or even just simply Robert Smith moving from Blackpool to Crawley.
Yeah, isn't that funny?
Yeah, you know, just it's how decisions that are out of your hands shape a life. But you can't possibly, you know, I write screenplays. One of the things that they say about screenplays is that they have to make sense.
Yeah.
Whereas real life never does. So what you've done, it makes sense of the chaos, which I think is a beautiful thing.
Thank you. That's an amazing compliment. Think so.
Well, on that positive note, I will say thank you very much for joining us on the BritFlix podcast.
Well, thank you, Stuart. It's been a pleasure as ever.
Indeed.
Another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.